Just order here.
Awesome.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, Ernie. You're muted.
I was just waving.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right. Am I seeing from staff we're all good to go here?
I believe so, Casey.
I think so, too. I'm just waiting for it to pop up.
All right.
All righty.
All right. Thank you, Casey. Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the Subcommittee on Minnesota Water Policy to order. It's November 9th. 2020 at 2 p.m. And if Casey could verify whether we've got quorum at this point or not.
We do have quorum.
Super. Well, the first time we have on the agenda for us on official business then is approval of the subcommittee meeting minutes from October 13th. Does anyone have any corrections or modifications, or if anyone would like to move approval?
Chair Fisher, I would move the minutes.
Super. Representative Poston moves approval of the minutes. Are there any corrections or additions? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes as sent out for October 13th, 2020, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion approved. Next, we'll move on to our first item of business on the agenda. We have discussion on a report on groundwater recharge. Executive Director Stark, if you'd like to take us through this part of the process and introduce our speakers, please.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much for being here today. I appreciate it. Today we're going to have a presentation. That presentation will be by Dr. Kerry Jennings and I think John Bellotta. Dr. Jennings is from the Freshwater Society. John Bellotta is at the University of Minnesota, the Water Resources Center. They, along with several others, have been working on a project which looks at the feasibility of doing groundwater recharge or groundwater banking, if you will, both technical, political, financial feasibility of doing that. So with that, I will turn this over to Dr. Jennings and to her presentation.
Thank you. And you're going to bring that up, right? Or Casey's going to bring that presentation up?
No, you have to present your own PowerPoint.
Oh, I thought okay, that's going to be problematic. Do you have the copy? I have to do this on my phone because of my broadband issues. I thought sending it to you Friday meant that you were presenting it. I'm very sorry.
Casey, are you able to do that?
I might be able to. Jim, you got to take down your PowerPoint.
Thank you. Well, I can get started. I was writing the executive summary for this report. As you recall, this is something that we came to the legislature with an idea that we had 2 years ago now. And Representative Sandell was one of the authors of this legislation. We were originally asking for $350,000 from the general fund to work on this concept of banking groundwater. We felt like it was a tool that the state might need to use at some point, and we needed to understand what the barriers to implementing it were. At the end of that session, this became part of the omnibus bill, and eventually it was funded actually through money returned to the LCCMR. So this was LCCMR funded, but it didn't go through the regular LCCMR process. So what we proposed was kind of a quick study, 18 months, because we wanted to get back to you at the beginning of this legislative session with the results so that you could act on them. The summary that I'm starting to write up for the report that we are now sending around to stakeholders starts, I think, accurately, but sometimes when you talk about water, it can sound melodramatic. But I start by saying there are no substitutes for water. It's essential not only to life, but our economy and the environment. And at the same time, it's really hard to evaluate the social and environmental worth of water. And you must face this all the time as members of this committee. Thank you so much, Casey. So you see the first. I'm sorry, was that a question for me or somebody just not muted? Can somebody mute the other microphones?
Bringing us to a global suite of 1.87.
Senator Goggin, you're unmuted there. Could you mute yourself, please?
I'd like to start with the first item, which is...
Can you mute all the other people on the call, potentially?
Phase 2. So we've got Scott Coleman.
Casey, are you there?
I'm here.
Can you mute all of us?
Yeah. All right, thanks.
I don't know how I can talk over that.
PRG last June and funded. The reason we're back here is related to what you just mentioned about the capital budget.
Senator Goggin, can you please mute yourself, please?
Now he appears to be
okay.
Muted.
Okay. Thank once you. I have the PowerPoint up, then I lose my ability.
Yeah, he's muted now.
Okay.
Okay. So back to this project. So what you're looking at now is a schematic of a well drilled into the ground. Oops, it advanced. Can you go back to that schematic? So this, normally the way a well works is you're drawing water out of an aquifer, which is represented by that blue layer down there. And this is looking at the possibility of injecting water in through a well into an aquifer, having it buffered with the native groundwater, and then removing that same water for use later on. So it is actually banking and storing and then recovering the same groundwater. Let's go on to the next slide with the core team members. This is an interdisciplinary project because it involves not just the science of groundwater and the geology of where that water is stored, but also the engineering requirements. Bill Arnold looked into the engineering requirements. His master's student, Josh Kirk, just graduated, defended his thesis yesterday. It's a policy. We had Lucia Levers and John Bailata looking into the policy, and Eileen Kirby assisted with that. Peter Kong is actually the groundwater modeler. He worked with an international team, has already published on the results of his work about what it takes to inject into an aquifer and how that aquifer doesn't flood or move water into other areas. Tony Runkle provided the geologic information. He's with the Minnesota Geological Survey. And then Brian Bowman and I were working on policy, but also just keeping this team organized. Next slide. So the motivation behind this is really, we know that there are projected demographic trends, projected climate trends, and then just groundwater use trends that are leading to impacts of people using a shared water resources. We see maybe communities competing with one another for the same water, or maybe a community in a surrounding lake. And that's supposed to make you think of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and White Bear Lake and pumping around that. So next slide. So, you know, we think this is something that we need to understand. There are some obvious first steps. I think you might need to click on something. There we go. The obvious first steps are to encourage groundwater conservation. Let's just go ahead and click on these. It's a short list. And then we should probably be eliminating barriers to using water more than once. And that's water reuse. And those are efforts that have started. But it's possible that some areas may still come up short. So let's go to the next slide. As you could tell from our team, this is a lot of overlapping study areas. And I felt kind of validated after we designed this project to find this paper written in 2014 that showed exactly the areas that we were wanting to cover on this project. So we are doing all of these things. We have done all of these things. And the other thing that was validating, if you go to the next slide, is to see how aquifer recharge is used around the world. One of our policy people came up with a project map like that was interactive. This map is not, but you can go to the website and find this map and click on each one of these dots, and they'll tell you how much water is being recharged, why it's being done, how long it's been done, and there's even some details about the engineering aspects of these projects. So it's done around the world. In places, it's done for obvious reasons where they have long-term droughts. Other places along the coasts, it's to keep salt water from intruding into the freshwater aquifers. But close to home, we saw significant aquifer recharge happening in Iowa. And this was really interesting because Iowa has some of the deepest aquifer storage and recharge wells in the world. Next slide. And the reason these areas are doing this is because some of them want to create reliable seasonal water sources. They might have excess water at times of year, but the drought at other times of year. Think of monsoonal climates. And so this helps them address seasonal water shortages. Others are trying to meet the peak demand of their plants, like in the hot summer months, without building a larger treatment plant because they don't need it in the winter. Or they might be interested in reducing their energy costs from pumping really deep or pumping at times when energy is expensive, like in the summer in Minnesota when you're spending a lot on cooling. Others want to make their water reserves less vulnerable to contamination. For example, Minneapolis and St. Paul with their surface water sources are highly vulnerable to a contamination plume that might be coming down the river, and storing water in an aquifer would be safer to that kind of surface contamination. Or some places, the land is just too expensive. Think Korea or Tokyo. It's just too expensive to use a large reservoir at the surface, or it might be vulnerable for other reasons like earthquakes. And so you can conserve land area by storing water underground. Next slide. So we wanted to look at different reasons. I feel like a slide was missed. Maybe I just took one out there, but there should be a map of the study areas. Did you see a map? Okay, well, I can just, maybe that final slide got deleted. The things that you consider when you're injecting water into the ground, these are pretty simple, and these diagrams make it look really complicated. But in the case of where water, the blue layer is the aquifer, is confined by a layer that doesn't allow water to move through it, you don't want to pump so much water into the ground that you actually break that geologic layer and allow the water to come out through fractures. So there's a limitation as to how much water you can pump in because you don't want to change the pressure that much. In the case of an unconfined situation, you don't want to pump so much water into the ground that it actually starts flooding the ground. So those are kind of the two limiting conditions for how much you can inject. The rest of it has to do with how freely water moves through these aquifers. So you could, I always imagine some thick drink like a milkshake from McDonald's or a slushie from Quick Trip or something, and how you can draw down or put water into an aquifer only at a certain rate because of how quickly it moves through, like the little ice cubes in a slushie. So, you know, a lot of it has to do with how permeable and porous these aquifers are as to how quickly you can recharge them. Next slide. I think it's going backwards now. There we go. So we chose to look at four areas. You're only seeing three of them here because I see there's our map. So with the four areas that we were looking at was, so we started with the Fargo-Moorhead area. Moorhead in particular with the Buffalo Aquifer, and that's the long skinny aquifer you see on the left. Kind of runs along the border of Clay County in western Minnesota. We next looked at the Pineland Sands Aquifer, and you won't see a final map for that area because what we realized there was not a source of water to recharge this aquifer. They were dealing with seasonal depletion from irrigated agriculture. But Park Rapids, which is the largest city in this area, is at the downstream end of that aquifer, and it doesn't have a wastewater treatment plant to generate water to recharge it. And even if it did, it would have to be pumped all the way up to the headwater. So that is not a place where recharge is going to happen. The other two examples, we looked at bedrock aquifers in Woodbury and Olmsted County, centered on Rochester. And what you're seeing in these hot color maps is the darkest red zones are places where the water would be easily accepted. So if you were to put a well centered on that dark red area, that's where you could store the most water the most quickly. So those places have the most recharge potential, the most injection capacity. So we were really happy with this because the rest of the world doesn't have such permeable and porous aquifers that we have. The glacial aquifer in Moorhead and these bedrock aquifers are really suited to this potential. Next slide. And just to show you kind of how the numbers work out in the Woodbury area, if you look at just an estimate of the population and the current water use, and that's kind of a high water use because it includes industrial uses, but it's the water use divided by the population, you almost like have a half of a cubic meter. Next, click on the next couple lines. I'm gonna do some math here. That if you just multiply that out, you would see how much water is required for Woodbury for a day. Next slide. And then if you look at the injection capacity of the aquifer for Woodbury, it's really good, high injection capacity. It would take 30 days to inject 380,000 cubic meters of water. Next slide. And so if you did injection for 11 days per month, next slide, then you would need 9 wells operating for 3 months. It's not a hard thing to do this. Woodbury actually would be a pretty good scenario. Most places that do injection do it over all of the winter months when the water use is lower. Water use goes up significantly in the summer when people are watering their lawns and irrigating. Next slide. So the barriers that we've identified for moving forward with this as a state, it was quite hard actually to get the aquifer pump test data to estimate the injection capacity of these aquifers. It exists out there because when people drill wells, they do short-term pump tests, but people also do longer duration pump tests to understand their aquifers, maybe to model plumes of pollution that might be moving, or there's other modeling reasons people might do that, but it's a database that's not very well organized. And so one thing we could do as a state is make those data sets more available. The other identified barrier is currently the state doesn't have the authority, or even the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act doesn't allow for the injection of water or the injection of anything. And if we were to move ahead with this, first we would have to assume the authority from the EPA to inject anything into the ground. And then we would want a clear permitting path and some maybe, I don't know if the 1989 Groundwater Protection Act needs to be changed, but just some reinterpretation of how it's been used so far. We do have one existing aquifer storage and recovery plant in St. Michael, and MDH did that by variance. So we do have kind of the framework for what a permitting path would look like. And then we have a wonderful infrastructure or agency work on water in Minnesota, definitely siloed approach. We have Department of Health working on drinking water, PCA working on contaminants, DNR working on ecosystem services for groundwater. It's intentionally siloed, but that also makes something like this hard to organize. I've been trying to get ahead of this by meeting regularly with the interagency groundwater team and updating them on our work, but there would have to be some coordination among the agencies if we would move forward with this. And let me finish with the last slide by showing you that we're kind of proud and patting ourselves on the back a little bit for our study area selection, because when we decided to look at Washington County and especially Woodbury, some people tried to talk us out of the selection of this because precisely of the PFAS contamination and just all the politics swirling around that issue. But in the last month, we were asked by the subcommittee that's working on potential remediation solutions for this problem. We were asked to present the results of our work, and now we've been asked to go forward with a study of how this could help with one of the scenarios for providing clean drinking water. And this is just showing you on the right-hand side, a map of the contaminated areas. And on the left, one of the scenarios proposed by the consulting group, which is to put a whole long line of wells on the upstream side of Lake Elmo, pump out a ton of groundwater and treat it. and use it for groundwater supply, but then you still have excess groundwater, and the idea would be to pump it back into the ground on the downstream side of Lake Elmo so that it could recharge the aquifer down on the downstream side, but also flush out some of the contamination on the downstream side. So we feel like we have helped the state move forward with their thinking even before this project is ending. And I want to congratulate the bipartisan team that sponsored this legislation, especially Representative Sandell, who was early in his first term when he agreed to help push this legislation through, get the study sponsored. And I also just want to finish by saying that even though this has only been 18 months, we've successfully had a postdoc and a master's student who are already going to be hired in the area to work in this field with private consultants and some publications. So I think if you engage the right people at the University of Minnesota, you really multiply state dollars because these people become highly specialized in this and stay in the area. So you are stakeholders as well. I would love to hear your impact. We're collecting impact for the next month and a half, and we'll incorporate that as the end part of our draft report.
Thank you. I see that we've got a question. Senator Weber, if you'd like to go first with your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think probably Ms. Jennings answered it, but I just want to make sure. In the first or second slide that was shown, it indicated that the water injected into the well was the water closest to the well casing, and then other water was beyond that. Is that typically going to be the case as long as you don't exceed the level of water you can put down there to and exceed the pressure that is down in that particular well?
Yeah, that is the goal of the, I'm sorry, yes, Representative Weber, Chair Fisher, that is the goal of the injection, is to recover that same water that you've injected. It's treated before it goes in, so you've invested in that water. And in some cases, you treat it again when it comes out, just to make sure it hasn't absorbed any contaminants while it's down there. But in cases where you're trying to restore environmental levels and want it to maybe come out through a fen or a trout stream, that's the only case where you wouldn't be recovering that water again, because you might want it to recharge groundwater-fed features.
Okay. Any other questions, Senator Weber?
No, that's good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Thank you. Representative Torkelson, you are next.
Well, thank you, Chair Fisher. Thank you for your presentation, Carrie. It was really, really very interesting. You had that map of all those sites worldwide that are using this type of process to manage water resources. I think it's amazing. I had no idea that it was that widespread. My question really is this always using a well, or are there other methods of recharging aquifers other than injection wells?
Dr. Jennings?
Yeah, Chair Fisher, Representative Torkelson. The simpler scenario would be something that's more generally referred to as managed aquifer recharge. And close to home, like in Nebraska, river water is redirected to a sandy area at the surface. And I could imagine this in the Watonwan watershed. If you get some sandy agricultural areas at the surface, you could redirect river flow to that, or any sandy area at the surface, you could just pond water there. Maybe even treat tile water, removing nitrogen and allowing it to infiltrate back into the ground in a place where it's sandier downstream of the agricultural areas. So there is a more passive approach to this that you would probably still want to manage the water quality for. We chose to study the more technical approach just because it's a little harder.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, no.
There were more big areas.
Representative Parkinson.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Thank you, Dr. Jennings, for that answer. Yeah, the advantage of using a non-injection style of recharge, you get the natural filtering of the water through that sand layer, gravel layer, or whatever permeable layer of the soil. Takes a lot of stuff out of the water too.
Yes, correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. I have a couple of questions. Dr. Jennings, first one is on water quality. What is the standards that you're using for the water being treated to before it goes back in? Is there a certain set of standards from the health department?
That would be some, Representative Fisher, that would be something that the health department would be very attentive to. And typically in these projects, it's treated to drinking water standards. In St. Michael, it's actually fluoridated as well and stored in that state. The project in the state that got closest to completion was with the Shakopee, Minnewaukan, and Sioux community. And they actually created a built a mini treatment plant that was doing multi-stage treatment, including ozone and removal of all contaminants of emerging concern. And they ultimately didn't go forward with the project. They even injected that water into like a core of the aquifer material to see what the chemical reactions would be between the water and the host material. They didn't go forward with the project ultimately because the communities around them were concerned about it. And really, the geology turned out to be unsuitable. The water they injected would have gone into a valley in the bedrock and come right out the bluff face. So it didn't make sense for them to do it for that reason. But those are definitely concerns that were addressed in our study.
Okay, thank you. And then the next question I have for you, Dr. Jennings, is seeing that there are a number of other places throughout the world that this has been done, what have been any obstacles that has happened when they've been working with this in other parts of the world?
Yes, Chair Fisher. I think the obstacles closest to home are the ones that are most pertinent. And those would be the mobilization of elements that you would be concerned about, like arsenic or manganese. And that happens when you have water with oxygen that's injected into an aquifer where there is no oxygen, you start to create a different kind of reaction. So you definitely want to keep those drinking water standards in mind and keep those levels of contaminants low, the geogenic or the natural so-called contaminants. The other issue that can happen is you can potentially create something benign, that like the kind of stuff you get in your teapot when you boil water, but that will clog the pores of the aquifer and reduce the effectiveness of the project. And that actually creates kind of an economic issue with the project's functionality. So you would want to avoid any kind of clogging as well. So that's, again, attention to the chemistry of the source water and the host water.
Thank you, Dr. Jennings. And one of the questions, as you're mentioning on the chemistry, has there been much that's been looked at in the chloride content of the water that might be coming in? I know chlorides were starting to see more and more of a problem throughout the state. Was anything tackled on that issue at all?
Chair Fisher, I don't remember that coming up. I just looked at the results of the Bill Arnold student today. He was busy defending, but the source water he was looking at for two of the three areas was from the wastewater treatment plant, and wastewater can have a lot of salt in it. So you would want to make sure that that was removed and not at a level that would contaminate the aquifer.
Okay, thank you. That was one of my concerns, is from the wastewater plants, there can be a bit of chlorides in there. Thank you, Dr. Jennings. It was a very informative presentation. I'm double checking for any other hands out there. I see Senator Weber has his hand up. Do you have any further questions, Senator Weber?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I forgot to take it down.
Okay, no problem. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't missing anything. Thank you. Representative Heintzman. I'm seeing Representative Heintzman. If you'd like to ask your question, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this was covered. I think that you yourself asked something along these lines, but I want to boil down a little bit more specifically. Do we have examples around the world where we have good data of there being specific problems that we might be able to predict potentially happening if we were to use this technology in Minnesota? And if there are, what kind of problems can we foresee?
Dr. Jennings.
Yeah, Representative Heintzman, I think that the biggest issue would be with arsenic mobilization. We've seen that in Wisconsin and a little bit in Iowa. And what would really need to be done is careful characterization of the two waters that you're potentially blending. And this is another reason why the state might want to have a really well-organized database on aquifer properties, water chemistry, that we already know about, because that way we can anticipate these issues and maybe avoid whole aquifers where cities are looking at this. I should mention that while we were working on this project, a city came forward, City of Chanhassen actually, and said that they wanted to do this, that four of their seven wells were dry. And they had significant money invested in their current water treatment plant. And the four wells that were dry were finished in the glacial aquifer. The seven that still were flowing were in the bedrock, deeper bedrock aquifer. And so their idea was to pump from the bedrock during the winter and store it back in these glacial aquifers, which sounds like, you know, a shell game, but it actually does make sense. They had a decade's worth of pumping in these glacial sand bodies. This is a case, though, where we would want to carefully look at whether the bedrock water chemistry matched the glacial aquifer host chemistry well enough that we wouldn't be changing and mobilizing some arsenic that we know exists there but hasn't risen to the level where it's of concern.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Any other questions, Representative Heintzman?
That'll do it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Heintzman. Thank you, Dr. Jennings, for the presentation.
Mr. Chair, if I could, please.
Go ahead, Director Stark.
Mr. Chair and Dr. Jennings, I do have one other point I'd like to bring up, and that deals with a really grand experiment that was done on the St. Paul campus in the late 80s, I believe. It was called the Aquifer Thermal Storage Project. And the intent there was to see if they could pump down hot water from the heating plant, cooling water from the heating plant, which is hot, store it underground, then extract it in the wintertime. So seasonally, they would change waters. It was on the St. Paul campus. Carrie mentioned the teapot problem. And because that water was very warm, there were some significant problems with trying to store that water down for extraction. So those are geochemical problems, but a lot was learned, and a lot about the hydraulics, about how that water moves away after pumping, whether it can be recaptured or not, is all really important information. Although that project itself wasn't feasible, what was learned there would be very important. Those were in the deep bedrock aquifers underlying the St. Paul campus.
Thank you, Director Stark. Any final comments from anybody? Not seeing anyone. Thank you, Dr. Jennings, for the presentation today. Very much appreciate that. And Director Stark, I'll turn it over to you for the introduction for our next agenda item.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, I have several things that I'd like to provide you with updates and briefings on, and things that we might want to consider in the future. The first is the state water plan. So the Minnesota legislature directs the Environmental Quality Board to coordinate an interagency long-range water resource planning and policy effort called the State Water Plan. That is done every 10 years, and that's defined in statute. So that has recently been released by the Environmental Quality Board. It's the purpose of the 2020 State Water Plan is to establish a framework for aligning the state agencies, the legislators, legislative priorities, and local government in their programs and actions for the coming decade. That is a significant report. It's over, I believe, over 100 pages in length. I want to give you a couple of highlights, because I think we should hear from the Environmental Quality Board about this plan and what that may mean for legislation. This year, the plan focuses significantly on climate change in water, and climate models predict that Minnesota will see more precipitation by the end of the century, continued increases in heavy rainfall, and longer intervening dry spells, so more variability and warmer temperatures. So that's kind of the focus of the plan this year. But it deals with drinking water. It looks at what is needed to make drinking water safe and sufficient and sustainable. It looks at accelerating source water protection areas for communities to put emphasis on source water protection in groundwater, in water management, in preventing nitrate contamination of drinking water, increasing soil health, dealing with our aging infrastructure, both wastewater, stormwater, and drinking water, identifying opportunities to retain and store water and manage drainage, and improve monitoring and public communication. So many of the things that are called out in the state water plan are things that we have discussed here and heard other presentations on. I'll say a little bit more about the state water plan, how it fits into things later, but I think it's a really good report. There's a lot of things that this subcommittee should be considering, and I'd like us to be able to hear more in depth about this plan at an upcoming meeting. Any questions?
Not seeing any hands raised at this point. Thank you for the presentation, Director Stark. It does look like something that we'll want to follow up on. So thank you for that.
Great. And then I also want to follow up on an issue that we've heard about at our last two meetings, that being funding a stable source of funding for stormwater conservation districts. We heard from Leanne Buck and from Paul Gardner and from the Minnesota Watershed Districts Association and about some of the problems around stable funding for the SWCDs. As you know, the Clean Water Council has spent quite a bit of time looking at this. Paul Gardner spoke to us, as did Emily Javens, a month or so ago, about some of those options. And I had hoped we'd have some feedback on those discussions. My understanding is that the agencies are working at a proposed plan for funding equitably the SWCDs. They're not quite ready to release that yet, but they're working on that issue very, very strongly, and I think we'll hear more about it at our next meeting. So just a very short update on SWCDs, if there are any questions, Mr. Chair, about that issue.
Certainly. I see Representative Heintzman has his hand up. Representative Heintzman, go ahead, please.
Just a brief comment, Mr. Chair. As this committee looks at this issue, I hope that we are very cognizant of what we face in 2021 and the deficit that is projected. Hopefully, the discussion will center around existing sources of revenue as opposed to more pressure on the general fund or other resources that will be seeing some significant impact due to what we're going to be dealing with putting a budget together for the coming biennium. So I'm not sure, Jim, if you have had an opportunity to communicate that to the folks that are looking at this, or if the Clean Water Council is just moving full steam ahead with their previous sort of line of thought on this. Hopefully it is being considered. I guess that's really only the issue I was hoping to address.
Okay, thank you, Representative Heintzman. Director Stark, any other comments?
Mr. Chair, I think that issue of equitable sources of funds are really important to all those who are addressing this topic.
All right, thank you. I don't see any other hands, so let's go ahead and move on to our next item, which is an update on private well tests.
Okay, Mr. Chair and members, I want to give you a very brief update on this topic. We've talked about private well testing before. We've talked about how the Clean Water Act regulates contaminants in public supply wells, but there's no equivalent for that in wells that are individually owned and private. And the American Associations of Pediatrics has looked at this issue. There are about a half a million domestic wells in the state of Minnesota. Those are essentially unregulated. So I also wanted to tell you a little bit about other states. I think there are five states that require testing of wells when they're installed. Minnesota is one of those. There are three states that require testing of water from wells when they're installed and when properties are transferred. Those are New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Oregon. That is an issue that we've talked about before. In your packets, there is a letter from the Minnesota Water Well Association in support of that idea. There would be several avenues for legislation. One might be the requirement for testing when a property is listed. That would be protective both for the purchaser and the seller. It wouldn't necessarily be regulatory in nature, but would be just informative, like the disclosure requirement for other wells on properties. It might include a relatively small group of chemical constituents that would be required to be tested for, like they are for wells that are installed: arsenic, nitrate, bacteria, arsenic, for example, which are indicative of problems that might occur with other kinds of contaminants. Another option that might be considered would be to exempt wells that are have been installed after the well code, because those are generally protective and protected from interference and movement of contaminants in aquifers. And so that's just a topic I wanted to bring back to you, to tell you what's happening in other states and how this topic is being handled, and the need for keeping our domestic well water safe. So with that, are there any questions?
All right, we'll give it a moment. I don't see any hands going up at this point. Thank you for the update on the private well testing. At this point in time, Director Stark, are you hearing if the Minnesota Water Well Association is planning on proposing any legislation itself on the issue?
Mr. Chair and members, I haven't heard that directly, but they do have a letter of support in your packages. So that indicates their support for this. It's pretty much aligned, I think, with what we have discussed as potential legislative issues.
Okay, thank you. I see Representative Heintzman has his hands up. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to check in with Director Stark and confirm that we'll be hearing both sides of the argument. Hopefully there'll be others that are going to be invited to communicate on this issue. Of course, there's a number of concerns that our folks in the real estate markets have voiced on this issue. I'm just hoping that we can hear both sides, not just one.
Mr. Chair and Representative Heintzman, thank you for that question. The Minnesota Association of Realtors has weighed in on this. We can bring them back at our next meeting to give them floor for testimony, if you'd like.
It would be nice. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Stark, it would be nice if there is another presentation from those pushing the mandate to also then get some kind of feedback from others that are watching this issue and would be directly affected.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, sure. I can arrange that for us for our next meeting.
Thank you, Director Stark. Appreciate it. Any further questions, Representative Heintzman?
That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Next on the hit parade, we have Senator Draham. Senator Draham, go ahead, sir.
All right. I just wanted to touch on that. I have been in discussion with the Realtor Association on that topic and look forward for further discussion with the remainder of the group.
Thank you. Okay, you kind of died out at the very end there, Senator Draham. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, that's it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you, sir. Looks like we could have a robust discussion on this at our next meeting then. I don't see any other hands going up for this one, so let's move on to the update on the University of Minnesota Met Council's water supply plans, please.
Yep. Mr. Chair and members, thank you. This also will be brief. You have a document in your packets, which is called The Future of Drinking Water, that relates to this. So there are a number of things that are moving forward with respect to recommendations for safe and sustainable drinking water. We've heard about a couple of these, and we've heard about the state water plan today. So the University of Minnesota, in cooperation with Minnesota Department of Health, has prepared a report on the future of drinking water. At the same time, the Met Council has looked at safe and sustainable drinking water in the metropolitan area. And as I mentioned a while ago, the Environmental Quality Board also discusses this topic for 2020. So that those three reports are really thorough. They're very good. There is several hundred pages of documentation in those three reports. They do provide recommendations about sustainable and safe drinking water for the future, and I think they need to be looked at together. These reports provide valuable suggestions and consideration for policy legislation. I've tried to summarize them in this short document, but as I mentioned, these are hundreds of pages long. So my suggestion would be that we, as a subcommittee, look at these reports and evaluate them together by the subcommittee members and by including the authors of those reports and stakeholders. So this would take a few meetings. It'd take a bit of time, I think. However, it would result in a framework for legislative policy initiatives that would incorporate and synthesize these three reports, which have been given a great deal of thought, and prepare legislation that would ensure sustainable drinking water and safe drinking water for the future. So with that, I'm asking if we could continue this topic, coordinate it with the authors and with the other stakeholders, and work to bring back a framework for policy legislation for the near future.
Thank you, Director Stark. I'm keeping an eye out for any hands going up. I would say that given the size of the reports and the importance that they're hitting on, it would be good to be able to continue the discussion to get a further breakdown to have not only a better understanding, but also be able to have some discussion amongst us about what that would mean for potential future policies. I'm not seeing any other hands going up at this point in time, so not hearing any disagreements on that.
Mr. Chair and members, yes. Hearing that, I'll move forward with this and have a skeleton outline for you. And I'll be in touch with the authors of these reports to make sure they're working together and we can have a collaborative conversation.
That sounds great. Thank you, Director Stark. Then the next item is an update on the MPCA chloride management plan.
Mr. Chair and members, back to the topic of chloride. And you have a document in your packets called the Chloride Management Plan. So very recently, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has released a document called the Chloride Management Plan. This document is intended primarily for municipalities and others to help them look at ways to manage and reduce their consumption of chloride. But it covers much more than that. Again, this is a very substantial and long report. I believe my understanding is that this is the first such report in the state. So this is Minnesota is really leading on this initiative. That being said, I think there's opportunity for legislation and policy that would fit within the context of this plan. I think there are two potential topics of legislation. There may be more. The first would provide additional training in limited liability assurance for certified and trained applicators. The second would phase out over time home water softeners that regenerate salt based on time rather than on water consumption. These are really policy discussions, and I think you as a committee may want to consider them. The management plan is over 100 pages long, and I'm just going to give you a couple of updates from that plan. Reducing chloride is necessary to restore our degraded waters and to protect all our water resources. There are multiple sources to consider and a variety of options to reduce chloride. The plan outlines a strategy to reduce salt and to protect our lakes, our rivers, and our other water resources. Chloride enters our waters from a variety of sources, including salt applied to roads, water softener brines, agricultural fertilizers, industrial discharge, and land application of wastes and wastewater treatment plants. From a statewide perspective, road salts, fertilizers, and discharges from wastewater treatment plants and water softeners are the primary sources. In urban areas, winter maintenance results in most of the discharge of chlorides to our waters. In rural areas, water softener and water softening is one of the primary sources of chloride. The trends of increasing chloride concentrations in lakes and rivers and groundwater is expected to continue. Groundwater monitoring by the MPCA and others has found that sand and gravel aquifers in the metro exceed state standards for chloride for surface waters, primarily as a result of de-icing. So that's just a very short recap of that significant report. I think, again, this committee needs to hear from the authors of that report. I know they're very willing to come and present to talk about this plan, what it means, and how potential legislation may fit with some of the things that are called for in the plan. Mr. Chair, any questions?
Okay, thank you. I'm not seeing any hands at the moment. The one question I would have is, I noticed you touched on a little bit on the continued training possibilities for salt management or de-icing during the winter months here. I do know that we've had legislation that we've attempted to get through the legislature in the past, and I would imagine we'll probably continue to work on in the future. And so my thoughts are is that this is going to be something that there might be some synergies that might be coming out of this report. It'd be nice to hear from folks earlier so that if there's anything we need to modify in the legislation that we have out there that we can maybe incorporate it earlier on versus later on would be my thoughts at this point.
Mr. Chair, you're right. I think it would be appropriate to hear from the MPCA. The Save Our Salt organization continues to work on this topic, and it would be good to hear discussions from those who might be opposed to that limited liability legislation. So it continues to be a topic that needs to be discussed.
Okay. Thank you, Director Stark. I'm not seeing any other hands raised at this point in time. So the next item we have is the discussion of legislative recommendations for the 2021 session. If you'd like to go ahead and kick us off there, Director Stark.
Mr. Chair, yes, you also have another document in your packet, which is entitled Bill Prioritization. I'll just say a few words about this. We talked about it before, but I want to come back to you one more time on this. We have discussed bills that were in process last year. Those were introduced. They were the result of consensus decisions by the subcommittee. Most of those were moving forward when things stopped mid-March. Most of those bills involved policy decisions that had minor or little impact on the general fund. Detailed descriptions of all of those many bills are available for anyone to see them. You asked me, and I prioritized those into three categories. The first are bills that I think, in my opinion at least, are of highest priority. They involve policy rather than significant funding. They have bipartisan authorship with minimal impacts on the general fund. The second category are bills that involve policy and some level of bipartisan support and with small levels of impact on the general fund. And then the third category involves bills that also had bipartisan support, but that would require funding from a fund such as a general fund. So that document is in your packet. I would just ask you if you could take a look at that and identify and let us know if there are bills where you were included as an author if you no longer would support those. So that'd be my request of you, and I can compile that then and have that ready for you at our next meeting. Most of those have been introduced, and I would just ask you to take a look at them and see if your opinions may have changed on some of these.
Okay, thank
questions,
you.
Mr. Chair.
I will open it up this point to questions or comments. I will mention that as I've looked through here that the bills that I was on last time around, I would be interested in being on again. And any of them that there were several that I had that I've been chief author on, I'm willing to do that again. Or if somebody else is more interested in chief authoring some of those, I'd be willing to work with folks on that. I think we've done great work over the last couple of years, and I want to make sure that we don't leave things behind. And I see Representative Torkelson has his hand up, so I'll let him go first. Next. Representative Torkelson, go ahead.
My question is not directly related to the bills, but it's a topic that I think will be coming up. I don't know how many of you saw the article in the Sunday paper regarding a ditch out in Renville County, that there's a conflict between DNR and the county as to the jurisdiction and the potential work being done on that particular stream. I think it's, I forget the name of the stream offhand. Just a second, I think I printed out the art. Here we go. Limbo Creek in Renville County. I think this topic is going to be one that we'll probably be spending some time on in the legislature one way or another. It has to do with the public waters inventory and how waters are designated and listed on the public waters inventory. It's a very contentious topic. That inventory was first established, I believe, in the 1970s after a fairly thorough process that did vary somewhat from county to county. The issue kind of got revitalized by the buffer work we've been doing over the last number of years. And DNR just recently started this process of reclassification, and they have a long list of waters that they want to reclassify, but they're going about them kind of one at a time or just a few at a time. This is going to be controversial and I think should be on our agenda sometime in the near future and will probably be part of our legislative discussions this year.
Okay, thank you, Representative Torkelson. That's a good suggestion for us to start taking a look at that issue before we get too far into the legislative session.
Mr. Chair, if I could, please. I've highlighted that in my update that I send out, but I'll send that article out to all the members so they can be appraised of the issue there.
All right, sounds great. Thank you. And I saw Representative Heintzman had his hand up briefly. Representative Heintzman, did you have any comments or questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to comment that I definitely would like to participate in a number of the bills that we had in the last cycle, specifically the chloride issue, and trying to work on that would be of interest to me, whether it be water softeners and then also the liability issue with our applicators in the private sector is super important. Glad that's on the radar. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you, Representative Heintzman. Appreciate you, your interest and continuing to want to work on these issues. Appreciate that. I'm not seeing any other hands up at the moment. So I would say that everybody else is to take a look at the list. I would think that that will probably mean, and Director Stark, please help me as we zip through on this, because I know we have some issues around the subcommittee continuing on also. But the thoughts would be is that where we have bills that were listed on with chief authors, it might be helpful to find out if those who were chief authors in the past were planning to contact House Research or Senate Research to have their bills redone, or if that's something that we would like to have Director Stark start on that, start that process for us. So looking for a little feedback from the rest of the committee as we're trying to go forward, so we're not duplicating efforts and at the same time not assuming somebody else is taking care of it and we find ourselves getting going and not having all the bills teed up that we'd like to be able to address. Representative Heintzman, your hand is up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just before we just simply redraft everything, we might need to have maybe a conversation amongst the co-chairs. There were some issues, and I'm not going to be able to recall all of them, but as we're going through the bills, there were some, maybe for a lack of a better phrase, some poison pills inside of, I think, some good ideas. So if maybe the co-chairs could identify a few of those issues, it would be nice to potentially revisit some of the bigger priorities that we had in the last cycle that I think might have kind of fallen to the wayside because of maybe some more partisan approaches to issues. And I don't mean that as a criticism, just wanting to try to work on those issues in a way that maybe would be more feasible as we work through a process jointly with the Senate and the House.
Thank you, Representative Heintzman, for the suggestion. Well, that's a good idea, because with divided government, we'll want to try to find where we've got clear paths, where we can get some things through, and if possible, try to avoid some of the more thornier issues that might hold up otherwise good legislation. So I think that would be a good thing for us to try to figure out the best way to do that. And what would probably be helpful is for those who are aware of the poison pills is to, I would think, maybe let Director Stark, Senator Weber, and myself know, and then we can start trying to tackle some of those discussions as we're looking at legislation going forward. And I'm also open to other thoughts or ideas that people might have. I'm not seeing any hands up at this point in time, so I'll turn it over to Director Stark.
Mr. Chair and members, just a couple of quick things here. A week or so ago, the university held their annual Water Resources Conference. This is the first year it was done online. There were about 800 people that attended. I know Representative Fisher, Senator Eaton attended, maybe others did, but that was a very good conference. And I can send out just the list of topics that were covered. If you're interested in any of those, there's more information. I think they were all recorded. So if you want to hear any of those, I can get those for you, and I'll send out the agenda for that meeting. I'd also like to, I want to thank you for being here today. We got done in about an hour. I would ask if we could have another short meeting in December. I hope you're okay with that and would allow us to have another meeting. I want to thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Director Stark. First of all, I'll call on Representative Torkelson, who has his hand up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just backtracking very briefly to the legislative session. You know, we don't really know at this point how we're going to be meeting. Probably at least much of it will be remote. We do know that there's probably going to be very little, if any, spending money available. And I think we should keep those factors in mind. If we are going to have be meeting remotely, we may want to hold back on some of this legislation until the second year of the biennium, when by then I would hope that we are meeting in full force, and be the non-budget year, we might have a better chance of moving some of these things forward. Just thoughts kind of off the top of my head at this point as we approach a new biennium.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. I appreciate that. That's a great issue because we want to make sure we don't lose anything in the process by not introducing them now. So I think that'll take a lot of coordination between us to make sure that we've got that done right. I appreciate the thought is that we don't clog everything up now and then lose some things and make sure we don't lose anything down the road. The other part I know will be based on some legislation, make sure that the Subcommittee on Water can continue down the in the future. I know that originally we were thinking until COVID hit that we were going to be able to do something legislatively. From my understanding that the dollars for this is in the base budget. And so it may be a little bit easier for us to keep it going in the future. And that'll be one of the things that I know I'll be advocating for as we go forward. And I feel that the work that we've done over the last years have been very good in trying to find some good common ground on and trying to be more proactive on the water issues that face us. So I think that'll be something we'll continue. Representative Heintzman.
Chair Fisher, two things. First, to the point you just made, I think that you deserve a lot of credit, and you and your committee working on the priorities, a lot of priorities that have been discussed in this committee in, I think, a very positive bipartisan way. And then to Representative Torkelson's comment, a little tongue-in-cheek, I guess. I would hope that the committee would be conscientious of the challenges created by what we may see developing in the House and how we handle our legislative cycle as opposed to the Senate. And I wouldn't want the Senate to be at an advantage as they would be having the opportunity for meetings in person if the House were to organize itself remotely. Hopefully, Chair Fisher, you can figure out a way to make sure that we're on level playing field in these kinds of situations, and maybe delaying would provide that opportunity. Some of our major priorities to 2022 and the session there, if we're unfortunately unable potentially to have a robust conversation in person.
Okay, thank you, Representative Heintzman, for the suggestion. I'll make sure to pass it on. I know that in the House, they are going to be restructuring the committees quite a bit. I do know there's going to be fewer committees than we had before, so I don't have any idea yet what that will be. I'm hoping that within the next week or so, we'll find that out and then be able to do a little bit more planning going forward. But I look forward to working with yourself, Representative Torkelson Poston, and everybody else to try to figure out how we can best make sure that we're getting the proper discussion to happen and in a way where we're able to have it meaningful to make sure that the public is also being able to be engaged all the way through the process. So thank you for raising that. And we will continue working. We want to make sure that we continue working in a bipartisan way to be proactive on the water issues facing us here in our state. Any other things that you would care to add at this point in time, directors? Before I get to that, just following up on the other thing, as of right now, unless I see any hands, would everybody be in favor of meeting for a short meeting, probably about an hour or so, probably early to mid-December, I'm guessing around the same time frame? Representative Heintz.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I thought you suggested we should raise our hand to show support for a December meeting.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, yes. If we could, for those that are interested, if you could go ahead and raise your hand, that's probably the quickest way. Thank you. I'm seeing 5, 6, it looks like about half the people right now are open to that. And I know we've got a couple of people who aren't on today that would probably be available. I would suggest at a minimum then that it looks like we would probably have a quorum that we would try to meet. I know that there's, if nothing else is, we'll know what the committee structure is, can touch a little bit more on some of the issues that we're talking about today and that we gave guidance on to Director Stark for our next meeting then, if I'm reading this correctly. And you can lower your hands at this point.
Unless you'd like to speak.
Go ahead, Director.
Mr. Chair and members, I just want to thank you for being here today. We've tried to keep this short. I would like to introduce Michelle Weber, Michelle is executive director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. She replaces Greg Hubinger, who recently retired. So I think Michelle is in the group here. We are going to the chairs, and Michelle and myself are going to meet right after during this call. So just wanted to, introduce you to Michelle. She was the director of the Legislative Budget Office prior to this, and welcome her to the group here.
Super. Thank you, Director Stark. Ms. Weber, would you care to say a few words to us? Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you're looking at things going forward.
Sure. Hi, members. I'm Michelle Weber. I'm the director of the Legislative Coordinating Commission, and I took on that role on October 15th when Greg Hubinger retired. So big shoes for me to fill in replacing Greg. But as Jim indicated, I, prior to that, for 2 years, served as the director of the Legislative Budget Office. And I'll be working closely with Jim and with the chairs as we move into the next legislative session to make sure that the needs of the subcommittee are being met.
Awesome. Thank you, Ms. Weber. Are there any questions for Ms. Weber? Not seeing any. Thank you so much for being on today. I appreciate it. Director Stark, any final things for us to deal with today?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the meeting. It was a good meeting. I appreciate you being here, and hope you have a good Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Director Stark. Same to you. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody else. And I will therefore adjourn the meeting at 3:11. Thank you, everyone, for being here.
Happy Thanksgiving.